This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
11 a.m. bringing you a variety of local and regional voices on matters of local, regional, national, and even global concern. Since 1968, Portland's progressive talk radio source. Columbia River climate action, community demonstration against plans to export coal and gas through the Pacific Northwest. This Saturday, the 27th of July, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., workshops on topics including fossil fuel exports, health impacts of coal, and a direct action happening from 10:30 to 12:30. At 12:30, rally and speakers from across the region, the Cascadia region, on KBOO Portland, your source for progressive talk in the Portland area. 1:30 to 2:30 p.m., there's a direct action. Boats of all shapes and sizes will converge in the middle of the Columbia River under the I-5 bridge as a peaceful, symbolic blocking of the river to fossil fuel exports. Protesters will also march on the pedestrian way of the I-5 bridge. This is happening at the Vancouver Landing, a.k.a. The K, Q-U-A-Y, west of 100 Columbia Street, Vancouver, Washington, on the west side of the I-5 bridge. Coming up next this morning on KBOO, we present a talk by Rosalie Regal, author of two recent books, Doing Time for Peace, Resistance, Family and Community, and Crossing the Line, Nonviolent Resistors Speak Out for Peace. Rosalie Regal is a peace activist and oral historian who co-founded the two Catholic worker houses in Saginaw, Michigan. She spoke about her work on two books about war resistors who have risked arrest and sometimes long prison terms to speak in the loudest way possible against U.S. militarism. Rosalie Regal spoke in Portland on May 1st. This talk was recorded by Jenka Soderberg. Stay tuned. First, this announcement.
Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. for Roots of Rock and Roll. Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop. From the birth of rock and roll, the 50s and early 60s. Roots of Rock and Roll, only on KBOO Portland.
And that's coming up this very afternoon. Roots of Rock and Roll, KBOO. Stay tuned now for Rosalie Regal.
Hello, everyone. As an oral historian, I listen to learn. I'm also an activist, and I think for about the past 20 years, I've been trying to weave these two parts of my life together. In 1968, I met Dorothy Day, and she helped form my activism during the Vietnam War. I read everything I could about her and became rather steeped in nonviolence. But I wasn't an oral historian, and after the Vietnam War was finally over, I damped down my activism as well. As I said in my first book, buried it in love busyness, raising four daughters, helping my lawyer husband become elected judge, completing my doctorate, doing all these wonderful things, but a part of me was missing. After I finished my doctorate, I decided that the real way to learn about the Catholic worker was to stop reading books and start listening to people. So I wrote my first oral history without much training, and it was called Voices from the Catholic Worker. 213 voices told me what Catholic workers were and what they did. houses of hospitality, rural farms where people were supposed to learn how to work with their hands. That's now a very important part of the Catholic worker movement. And resistance. So I've always been drawn to the resistance part, but for 10 years I did have a house of hospitality in Saginaw, Michigan, and it was a lovely 10 years working with homeless women and children. I finally decided that my own grandchildren needed to be with me and left the house and moved to Evanston, Illinois. Shortly after I moved, I was sitting in a church basement, not quite as grand as this room, and listening to people talk about going to jail, talking about being war resistors who committed civil disobedience, who engaged in civil disobedience, and risk going to jail and prison. They invited me to join them to cross the line at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. Now, Offutt is a command center for all the weapons that the United States controls all over the world. And a very important protest site, actually, as I learned from the oral history I completed after this, has been a site for protest since the 40s. I listened to these people tell jailbird stories, and I thought, wow, it doesn't sound like the kind of stories that you hear on television of, you know, Brunhilde the guard and all these really kind of spooky things. Without too much more thought, just after that night, I did decide to cross the line at Offutt in a very simple, very orchestrated action where we had six police officers, one for each person. The whole thing took about 10 minutes. We knelt down, we said a prayer, they arrested us, they let us go. We had to come back twice for trial, but I didn't go to prison, which was probably a good thing because I didn't know much about what it was like to go to jail. What I got was a scolding from the judge. He said I should know better, being so old. But I decided I needed to learn. So once again, I did an oral history project, called it Doing Time for Peace. It resulted in two books. Now, they're not volume one and volume two, they're companion books. The first book concentrates on family and community and what it's like for people whose husbands, mothers, children decide to engage in civil disobedience because they care so deeply about our country being at war. The second one is more historical, although they both have a chronological focus, because I wanted to show, and I think the 173 interviews taken together do this, that war resistance has a long and noble history in our country. There were, for instance, war resistors during the First World War when they were talking about executing them. Ammon Hennessy, who later became a Catholic worker, was a war resister in the First World War. Eugene Debs ran for president as a socialist while he was in prison for resisting war. During this, and of course, there is nobody left from the First World War to interview. But I was blessed to be able to interview six men who were COs during what we called the Good War. Howard Zinn has pointed out that the Good War wasn't so good after all. And if you were in Europe during the 50s and 60s and even 70s and 80s to see the bombed out cathedrals that we bombed, the quote collateral damage caused by our devastation of Europe, you'll know that there's a lot that wasn't good about the Good War. The resistors who went to prison during the Second World War, most of them, four of them actually, were seminarians, the Union 8 from seminary in New York with Dave Dellinger, who later, well, most of them did continue to be protesters for their whole lives. But Dave Dellinger was the one that was famous, was Chicago 7, and just a really, you know, very important name in the anti-war movement and in the civil rights movement. Those men have all passed on. Ralph DeGioia, wonderful, wonderful War Resisters League secretary for years and years, had passed on as well. But one, Dick Van Korf, is still alive, still feisty, still convinced that wars are wrong. The only way to stop them is to refuse to fight. He was encouraged to be a CO by his Methodist wife, and he left a small child to go to Sandstone. He was later pardoned by President Truman, pardoned most of, not all of them, but most of the World War II COs. Vietnam men didn't fare so well. Some draft refusers in Vietnam served up to 5 years in prison. I was able to talk to Robert Wolheim of Portland, who was with me most of the day today. He's now appellate judge. He was a man who refused to step forward when he was drafted, and he was jailed down in Stafford, Arizona. And a Supreme Court decision that he had been incorrectly called up for induction was able to be released after 5 months, became very active in worker rights, and became a lawyer and was elected appellate judge, appointed and then re-elected appellate judge. Wonderful man, and it was just wonderful to be with him today. I also, when I was in Portland in 2004, interviewed someone who lived most of his adult life in Portland, Johnny Baranski. Johnny Baranski was a Catholic worker in Portland who had done a very interesting draft file destruction action during Vietnam War, where I live now in Evanston, Illinois. And he had been a recent college graduate, four young college graduates, two men and two women, poured blood on draft files, very calmly, very prayerfully, saying, one of them, some were pouring the blood and some were reading the Bible, stood around, waited to be arrested, were tried, didn't receive really big convictions. The interesting thing about it was that it was the same time as the Chicago 7 trial. So the media, which likes contrast, likes conflict, the bad guys were the Chicago 7, the good guys were these young college graduates. And as Johnny said, hey, we were all working for the same change. You know, it was just the media had to kind of market them that way. Johnny then moved out, and his wife, Grace Baranski, who I have not met, but I've known quite a few people who have, was in a very important West Coast action called the Trident Blockade against the arrival of the submarines in Puget Sound. She was in one of the boats that went out to greet the first nuclear submarine. Kim Wall was in that boat as well, and gave me, I think, a very thoughtful interview, and I thought I might read a little bit from Kim's interview. She was a young mother, had actually her oldest daughter, she had children at home, and her oldest daughter was, I think, married and pregnant when this was going on, and she learned later that the daughter was sad that she had, you know, not been quite as present as she would have been because she was preparing for this blockade. there was a tremendous amount of publicity for this blockade, and Sojourner's Magazine and lots of national newspapers were giving them a lot of press.
What year?
This was in 1977. The 1982. The campaign started in 77. The Volts actually did the blockade in 82. Volts came from other countries. Bishop Hunthausen was out on the water. It was just a tremendous, tremendous protest. But the actual arrests weren't as great as they thought they were going to. Kim, Grace Baranski, an older woman who was had been Mother of the Year, and two men were in one of the boats. And they got very close to this great big huge nuclear sub, and the Coast Guard is coming after them. The Coast Guard was going to hose them into the water with the kind of hoses they use for to fight fires. Well, Ruth Nelson was this older woman who'd been Mother of the Year, and she looked up at this young Coast Guard guy, and she just looked at him, and she said, "Not in my America, young man," and the guy backed off. So they did not hose them. They arrested them, but they did not hose them into the water like they did the rest of the people because of this older woman, which is his tremendous presence. Anyway, it was a very scary time. Later, Kim, the woman I interviewed, said, "Why didn't we worry about drowning?" And one of the nuns that had been participated in the protest said, "Because we thought we were going to die." You know, they really didn't think of the consequences. But they kept on. After the blockade, after the Trident nuclear submarines came, they, at Ground Zero, and people all over the country, organized the white train protest because they discovered that there was this train going from Texas all through the heartland of America to Seattle to deliver nuclear weapons, the components for the nuclear weapons. Tremendously dangerous, and painted an ominous white and moving at night and just all the spooky things. So all along the tracks were these groups protesting these trains, getting arrested, sitting on the tracks, which they decided was too dangerous. But they did get the train to stop, didn't stop the nuclear weapons coming to the plant, unfortunately, because they just switched to trucks, which were much harder to trace. Very exciting times, very traumatic times, but very prayerful times, because it was during groups like, during protests like this, that people learned the value of community. And Kim talked a lot about the community that they built, the prayerful communities that they built over these protests. Kim had a Catholic girls' school education. One of the questions I ask her is, did some of the old good girl stuff kick in when you'd go to trial? And she said, "You know, I don't think I ever felt cowed by the judges. People would tell me that the judges occasionally deferred to me because I was a suburban doctor's wife. So I tried to watch out for that and always be respectful but clear." She said, "We do a lot of preparation, and so when they had a chance in their trials, they could speak very definitely to the issues." She told me that everything in this protest was of a piece. The preparation, education, learning about the issue, the trainings and nonviolence so that they would react appropriately when the police would arrest them, the decisions of logistics, what they would do, how they would act together, the arrest, the trial, and the prison, all a part of a whole. It wasn't just crossing the line. she would do trainings for people, and they'd have long discussions about, is civil disobedience the way to go? Is it the way to go for me personally at the time, or is it something that I should delay or possibly not do at all because maybe I'm not psychologically prepared for the trauma of prison? So she would work this all out. I asked her about her children. What did her children think about all of this? And she said, the children helped out and supported us. A lot of stuffing envelopes. I remember my kids helping me do that during the Vietnam War. Folding newsletters, that kind of thing. Setting up for meetings. But she said, but when I got close to the blockade, when she was going to be doing this really risky action, Kate seemed to be more upset than the others. I said, well, Kate, I just have to do this. And she said, you don't have to do this, Mom. You want to do it. So I always had to live with that. You know, I still went ahead and did it. We were so caught up and so determined on saving the world from this nuclear scourge. She paused and she said, and we didn't. Then she went on, in a sense, the children were the reason we did it. They were the heart and soul of our work as we sat through all the meetings and did all this background work. They were the reason we were there. I said, how do you feel now about all of this? I interviewed her probably 20 years later. And she paused for a long minute. She said, when I'm feeling my best, I say we made an impact. That people, and she paused, she said, our lives were changed. And they had talked about a reunion and all the people that she had met and all the community that was built. She said, people changed. People left Boeing. People left Burlington Railroad that had organized, that owned the white train. Workers left Bangor. But our campaign merged into the Boeing campaign and then became, I think, more of a Christian support group, and the activism stopped. And then she said, I'm not sorry for a minute I did it. I deeply regret that we didn't stop the violence. For 13 years, I knew what I was supposed to be doing. I don't know now. Kim's not knowing seemed to reflect what several of the people I talked to said, that they are frustrated because what they've done, what many in our audience have done for years and years doesn't make a difference. We keep having more wars. We keep going into more countries. We keep expanding empire. So as I organized the second book, I myself had to look for hope. I've been working on these interviews, listening to their words from, as I started in 2004, Doing Time for Peace came out in November of 2012, and I was finishing this up during last Christmas, December and January, and it came out January 31st. Putting together all of these interviews, editing them, not including a lot, because people would sometimes make repeat and I'd have to choose the one that said the right thing, the most, you know, said it most clearly. I had to find hope for myself. And I decided I would try to, I hope, share this hope with other people. My college roommate, who we really don't, undergrad roommate, we don't really agree on a lot of things. But she gave me a beautiful statement by Victor Havel that I would like to share with my audience. Hope is a state of mind, not of the world. Either we have hope or we don't. It's not essentially dependent on some particular observation of the world or estimate of the situation. I'll come back to that in a minute. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy that things are going well, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, not because it has a chance to succeed. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. So I chose that as the beginning of the book. And I didn't choose just interviews that showed hope. You know, that's why I started with reading Kim's, because I didn't want to sugarcoat this thing. War resisting is serious business, and people who go to jail give up a lot of freedom. And I didn't want to sugarcoat it, but I wanted to show what these people were like. In late January, I was speaking at Potter's House Books in D.C., and a wonderful lawyer named Mark Goldstone stood up and introduced himself. He had represented, still does represent, a lot of war resisters and people who commit engage in civil disobedience for other issues as well. And many people who resist war also are working on climate change and a lot of the issues that our military budget exacerbates. So, I mean, it is all connected. Anyway, Mark stood up, and I gave him the floor because I was really glad to meet him. And he said, you know, I don't think civil disobedience is going to work in the peace movement anymore. He said, it may work in the climate change movement, but I don't think it's going to work in the peace movement. He said, for instance, before the Iraq War, everybody was against it, and we're all out on the streets, and we're marching. Probably everybody here tonight was out protesting. I know we were doing 24-hour-a-day vigils in Saginaw, Michigan, and lots of little towns like that were doing it, as well as all the big things, all the big marches in D.C., all the marches all over Europe. And we still had the war. They paid no attention to us. They wanted that oil. They wanted the war for a million bad reasons. Nobody paid any attention to us. And he used that as an example that protest for anti-war movements was basically dead. So he sat down. And as I said, the book was just out when I, it just been out a couple weeks when I gave his presentation. And I said, well, you know, Mark, that's one way of looking at it. But let me give you another way. And I read the end of the interview, which I chose as the epilogue for the book. So I started the book with the Victor Havel quote. And I ended it with an interview by Grace Paley. Now, Grace Paley was, I call her an icon of my younger years. I taught her as an English teacher at Saginaw Valley State. I can't say I lived as she did, because she was much more active as her children were growing up, and I was much more just reading about it. But, you know, we were almost the same age. I interviewed her. She was dying of cancer, but still just so gracious and warm, and I knew I would not see her again. She ended her interview with, first she was talking about why middle-class, middle-aged people need to get arrested, because she said, we have the freedom to do it. Young women, young black women particularly, who might lose their job the minute they got arrested, shouldn't be doing things like that. You know, you have to think of the big picture. But if you have the freedom, if you have the kind of work, I have a wonderful interview from a college professor who manages to work his arrest so that he goes to prison during breaks in summer. You know, you can work it out. It's tricky, but you can work it out. A lot of people who are professional resistors live in community, and that's one of the things I'll talk about in a minute. But, so she did that, and then she say, that's the reason, you know, middle-class white women and men have to go to prison. The point is, if it's hard for those persons, I have to do it for you, so that we represent, we who have the freedom to be able to go out of prison, represent for those that don't have the freedom. And then she said, I'll tell you one hope I have. And I go, excited to hear that word, hope. The time before the latest Iraq war is the first time in history that every nation in this new world was opposed to us beginning a war. There have been lots of times when people have been trying to stop a war after it starts, but this is the first time when everybody was trying to prevent a war from happening, that we all got together. So she said, so I tell the young people, she works a lot with the Code Pink up in Vermont where she was living. She said, I tell them, remember that. In your time, that happened. For the first time, all the nations on the earth said, don't go to war. Lesson for the day. And I read that to the group, and I said, you can just look at it two ways. You can look at it, we all got together, we tried, and we failed, so go home and watch television. Or you can look at it and say, we all got together for the first time. Grace Paley said it that way. So I leave that to you. You can do what you want with the fact that we did all get together. There was a tremendous unity. It's an individual decision, and in the talks that I've given in the last 3-4 months, people have good discussions about this, and I think maybe we'll have that in a minute. I'd like to give a few more stories that talk about the personal part of what going to prison is. First of all, you need to, and almost everybody said this, have a passion. Years and years ago, one of the founders of the Detroit Catholic Worker, Father Tom Lumpkin, told me, if you're going to be doing something that takes a tremendous amount of commitment, you need to have some sort of an affinity with it. And he used himself as an example. He says, I would do just absolutely terrible running for political office. And yet we need people to run for political office. We need people to write letters to the editor. We need people to be in the classroom teaching peace studies. We need people to go to jail. We need people all across the spectrum. And so you need to kind of, as he told me, and this was like early on in my career as an oral historian, he says, you need to have some sort of, you need to like doing it, and if you do, you're usually good at doing it. That was something I was blessed. I love doing the interviews, and I think because of what I think I was good at it. I got people to open up their hearts, to tell the truth, I think. Sometimes I could sense they weren't quite telling the truth, and I usually didn't use those interviews. You know, I called it listening with a third ear. You just sort of had a sense when you were talking. But I love doing it, as just as I love talking about the wonderful people that I interviewed. And Tom said that it's not like the olden days when we weren't supposed to enjoy something. But you know, you can love going to the meetings and doing all the organizing. That's not my favorite cup of tea, but we need people to do that. We need people to cross the line. We need people that like to talk in court. I'm not very good at that. I would just as soon not, but if it's part of it, I do. Will I go to jail? You know, I had the excuse of the book for 8 years. Now I don't have the excuse of the book. So we'll see. We'll see. I have my drone t-shirt on tonight. Drone is getting to be a hot button issue for me, and I think for a lot of other people. We just, the unfairness of it all, the Star Wars quality of it all. We're having more and more drone arrests. I was arrested at Creech Air Force Base a year ago, September, and they dismissed the charges. They didn't want a trial. But Hancock, in upper New York State, loves trials. And there were people arrested last week that had, you know, there's going to be big trials. Brian Terrell, I'll read a little bit of Brian's interview. Brian Terrell is in jail in Yankton Prison up in South Dakota now for a drone protest. Brian spent a lot of time in prison. He's been a Catholic worker for years, and because he lives in a community, he's able to take the time. Also, he's able, because he has a tremendously important wife, he lives on a Catholic worker farm. Betsy does most of the farming. Betsy does a lot of the farming and brings in a significant part of their low income. That's another thing. People who regularly go to prison usually live below the poverty level. They don't have corporate jobs. They don't have jobs that they can't leave. Farming is good if you've got somebody else to come in and do the work. People can replace you. Brian had some interesting things to say about education. He might have done this kind of to get me because I was a college teacher for years. I've spent about the same amount of time in jails as I've been in college, about a year altogether. Not one straight year like college, but a few months here, a few days there. I think it's increased since I interviewed him in 2004. It's interesting. I'll go for months without thinking of my year in college, but not a day goes by where my jail living doesn't come to mind. Not a day that I don't find something useful in that experience. And then he sort of looks at something that we wouldn't think much about. He says, for one thing, you learn how little you really need, like how to do your laundry in a tiny sink. I thought it was kind of a neat thing for a guy to say. He's in Yankton right now. Writes a lot of letters. There's a lot of time to write letters because that's one of the things about jail. Time will sometimes hang heavy on your hands. So in many ways, I think this book is a how-to book, both of them, on how to do time, how to have, first of all, a spiritual practice of some sort. It could be Buddhism, it could be yoga, it could be silent meditation, but almost everybody said you need to have some spiritual depth before you go in. There is a lot of services in jail, a lot of chaplains, a lot of discussion about what chaplains are like. Somebody called them cops with collars, you know, because if they're paid by the prison, they have to be trained to shoot. So it's kind of jarring to think of a minister being trained to shoot. Now, the volunteer ones, they come from outside. They don't have that. They don't work for the Bureau of Prisons. So they're often much more in tune with serving the men. And I did a wonderful interview with a couple who became interested in prison ministry by going to prison for war resistance. One of them does ministry to the prisoners, prayer services in Spanish and English. Before he started doing it, they were just doing prayer services in English, and the population was about 80% Spanish in Fresno, California. Now they have it in both languages. But Lisa Apper realized how much the guards needed help too, how stressful their job is, how many of them are sort of captive to the prison. And so she does counseling with the guards. So I thought that was really an interesting kind of outgrowth. Everybody who goes to prison for war resistance is changed, sometimes not for the good, but if they've gone in with good preparation and the right attitude about themselves and about who they're going to be living with, mostly they think it's a tremendous learning experience. The young people or the older people who did it when they were young, talk about it as a coming of age experience, an exhilarating experience in a way where you realize you can live your conscience. And that's very empowering, I think, for everybody. But particularly if you're young and just finding out who you are. Brian tells an interesting story. One of his first times in jail was at the D.C. jail. Now, that's a tough place. As you know, a tremendous depressed population in our nation's capital. They arrest so many black men there that they had the papers filled out with black hair, black skin, black eyes. They had to find, they'd find white out and make a form to Brooke, Brian, and Father Larry Moreland, who was another white man who was blonde. He says, this was a real reality check as to who DC sees as the criminals. Every time I hear of some white government guy doing something despicable, some really illegal thing, I think of that and realize that the DC jail doesn't even have the paperwork to receive the real criminals. The Watergate men, for instance, who were finally convicted, were sent to Danbury Prison, which had been a prison for a long time. World War II COs were there. It was new then. Dan Berrigan and Phil Berrigan were there as protesters during the Vietnam War. They did the whole thing over for the Watergate men, put in a swimming pool, the whole business. Ooh. Now it's a prison for women, no swimming pool. They filled it in. It's a volleyball court or something. I asked Brian how he interacted with the other prisoners, and I ask almost everybody that, and you get really different answers depending, again, on what people are good at. My good friend Renee Fulis, she was in the D.C. jail in the protests at the Democratic National Convention on immigration rights, actually. And she said, you know, I'm not very good at this. And she's wonderful with hospitality when she was living in the Catholic worker house for me. But she said, I'm just not very good in prison because I miss my creature comforts too much. So she says, I don't think this is where I belong in the peace movement. She has other talents galore. But many of the women resistors who go to prison really realize that they can serve and be served by the people and that they are incarcerated with. One of those who I think did a beautiful job with that is a Portland, was a Portland resident, Lisa Hughes, who had the Portland Catholic Worker for several years. Some of you may remember her. She's now in Africa working with, she's a nurse and she's working with children who are born with AIDS from their parents. I'm going to read a little bit that Lisa said about her jail experiences. Lisa had spent a lot of time in Central America, and she said she used to have trouble getting people to listen to her, to ask her to speak about her experiences working with peasants and the people that had had their land taken away from them and working in the villages. But when she went to prison for protesting at the School of the Americas, all of a sudden people wanted her to talk. Somehow the going to prison gives you an authority. And of course you do study the issues, so you do have the authority of knowing what you're going to do. But Lisa, probably because of her personality and her prior experiences, really had, I think, used the jail experience very, very well. And I liked her interview because it showed not only that she was able to help women, particularly in learning nonviolence while she was in jail, but she was helped by the women. She went to a minimum security prison called Greenwood. And she says, the women at Greenwood were just incredible. For instance, a group of Christian prisoners, when a new person comes in, they present them with a welcome gift, They keep a little fund and they go to the commissary and they get pre-stamped envelopes, paper and a pen, shower shoes, shampoo, lotion, thing, because you come in with nothing. The things that you might not get to buy right away. People do have a store they can buy, but the stuff is outrageously expensive for what you get. And so they give them like a wealth and gift. But she said the best thing was when you come into Greenwood, you get a white suit, a white like jumpsuit. And it just screams, new person, because everybody else wears green. So this group gets a green uniform and gives it to the people so that they become part of it right away. And that's a real community people thing if you're not set off as the newbie. I have a story of a fellow who was in the LA jail, which is a tough, tough jail, and how the different way that they inaugurated him into the prison life. I mean, they do it, but it's much tougher than what Lisa had. She talked a lot about learning with the women how to model nonviolence in the prison. And I thought this was really interesting. One of her friends was in, they call them the alley, but it's actually like a big dorm thing, long, long room. And she heard women hollering sexual comments down to each other. And she said to me, there were some black lesbians who were da-da-da-da-da. And so I had a little talk with her. I'm quoting Lisa here. She said, your issue with them is not that they're black or that they're lesbian, but that they're loud and they're using sexually explicit language. So that doesn't necessarily go hand in hand with being black. It doesn't necessarily go hand in hand with being lesbian. So she was just kind of pointing that out. And then another friend said to her, well, they need to have a separate friend wing for lesbians. And she said, well, maybe they need to have a separate wing for women who are sexually active. Because a lot of women in here wouldn't call themselves lesbians, but they're choosing to be sexually active while they're here. And when there are other people in here who are lesbians who are not choosing to be sexually active. So she worked with people, and there were, and she told other stories there about to get people to say, okay, what are you upset about and why are you upset about it? And separating out the issues. And during in doing so, I think she there was really a lot of growing going on with these women. And she talked about a fight that two women were having in the cafeteria, and she was able to say, you know, you could hit her, you'll get sent to maximum security, she was able to point out that, yes, she had the right to hit her because this woman had been saying some stupid things to her, but what will be the consequences? So she was really, with talking and bringing things up, she was really modeling the personal nonviolence that is so important for all of us to do. And of course, when Lisa got out, she did start a Catholic worker house specifically for women who had just been released from prison. And when I was here in 2004, I stayed there. So she had a really, I think, positive effect on the women who were in prison and was affected positively with them. So it's not just all serving, it's being served. Another story that I just love, and it'll be the last story that I'm going to tell. Mark Koval is a young Catholic worker in Hartford, Connecticut, who did a plowshares action. Now that's a serious action where they symbolically beat swords into plowshares, specifically directed at what plowshares people call the taproot of violence, that's nuclear weapons. And they break into a nuclear weapons facility. Sometimes it's a boatyard, sometimes it's a naval base, sometimes it's a munitions factory, but something connected with nuclear weapons. And it's nonviolent, but it does include property destruction. Now, if you think that it's violent to destroy property, a lot of people worship property in our country, so you might have trouble with the plowshares action. Most people realize that property, that kind of property, as Dan Berrigan said, is improper. It doesn't have any right to exist because it's so death-dealing. Mark Koval was going to do support for a plowshares action because you need a lot of people to act as supporters, to help plan it, to maybe drive to the scene, to do support when people are arrested, to help plan the trial, to do the media work, just a whole lot of work. But during as he was going along, he and his wife talked about it, and he decided that yes, because he was a young father, his voice would be strong, because it's for the children that we're doing this. And what he told me, he said, what got me through that action, because he was scared to death, was thinking about his young daughter, you know, and his son who wasn't even in school yet. So what Luz and Mark did was they decided to ask the neighbors that they had been, he said, living interdependently with. He had a Catholic worker house, and they were probably providing a lot of food, a lot of support, a lot of rides, a lot of the kind of help you give to distressed mothers, basically, single mothers. And they asked them to help Luz while he was away, and they did. The neighbors just cooperated beautifully, and it really, he said, it was just very good for us to be on the receiving end and to have the people that we had been serving us. So that was another example, I think, of what the kind of sharing and community building that resistance can do. The other interesting thing that happened with Mark and Luz in the New Haven Catholic Worker, they were receiving money from the Archdiocese of Hartford to run their House of Hospitality. All of a sudden, after he did this plowshares action, the money dried up. It wasn't available. Well, the people in the parishes, the people that knew them, the people in the neighborhood, made so much fuss that they gave the Archdiocese gave the money back. I said, not very often when the Archdiocese listens to the people, but they did. So that particular family and Catholic worker community ended up getting more support after he did this plowshares action than they did before. Now, that doesn't always happen. People used to send Dorothy Day money and say, well, this is to thicken the soup, but you know, don't be planning it on resistance. And Dorothy would say, well, it's all of a piece. It isn't some money for soup and some money to support prisoners. It's all of a piece. And that's, I think, maybe the thing that I want to leave people with, that working for peace is part of helping our schools, helping if we could get more money out of the Pentagon and into things that are life-giving instead of death-dealing. And that's why I think the people in Doing Time for Peace keep doing it. I will be repeating the question so that we can get it on the tape.
You said that you're done. Now that you're done, you have to consider for yourself whether you would go to jail yourself. But I'm wondering, are you sure you're really done? You don't want to do more interviews or on any other subject?
No, I'm not doing any more oral history. I love doing it, but it's so time-consuming. And I've trained another person to do oral Catholic worker oral histories, and I've got lots of ideas for other oral histories that I share with people, but I want them to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think I just don't want big projects anymore. Also, I think I have to face this whole going to prison part of my life while I still have my health, because one thing I do say is don't go to prison if you're a brittle diabetic, if you've got high blood pressure and need a special medicine, or else you'll just go off the wall, because it's just crazy. The health care in prison is so bad that, I mean, that's a violent thing to do something that would endanger your life. And it's, you know, it's against nonviolence. So, you know, when I'm still healthy and my grandkids are old enough now that, you know, I don't have to do the daily care so much anymore, you know, I need to face this.
Mm-hmm.
I did learn prison is doable. It's not what I thought. It's not the end of the world. Sometimes war resistors are arrested and they... it's just like you spend all this money and all these legal fees trying to keep them out of prison. And I say, hey, don't plead bail, go to jail, get it over with. You know, that's sort of the pure way. It's not the end of the world. It's certainly not pleasant. Prisons are cold now. I don't like being cold. And the new prisons, the new jails and prisons are much worse than the old ones. People say they prefer the old ones. But it's not the end of the world. So, you know, mm-hmm. that's another reason I'm not going to start a huge project. Although people can think of a lot of reasons why it's not good to go to prison. And one of the young men that we were talking to last night said, you know, if you wait till the time is right, you'll never do anything. And that's true for life, I think. Mm-hmm. If you wait till you have all the knowledge, or everything is just perfect, you know, before making any decision, you'll never make a decision. Well, I think this has been a wonderful time. I enjoyed very much being with you, and I thank you. And I hope that by reading the books, people will be encouraged to metaphorically or actually cross lines and be nonviolent resistors who speak out for peace. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Rosalie Regal, author of the books Doing Time for Peace and Crossing the Line, who spoke about war resistors and prison in Portland on May 1st. Coming up next, we have the noon headlines followed by Moving On, so stay tuned.
The first annual Jim Pepper Native Arts Festival will take place Wednesday, August 7th and Saturday, August 10th at Park Rose High School Performing Arts Center, 12003 Northeast Shaver Street, Portland. Jim Pepper was born in Salem, Oregon and lived in the Portland area for many years. A jazz saxophone composer and singer of Native American ancestry, he became a pioneer of fusion jazz in the late 1960s. This event is sponsored by KBOO Community Radio and the Oregon Cultural Heritage Commission. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, July 26th. The Israeli Minister of Energy commented that he hoped peace negotiations between Israel and Palestine could start as early as next Tuesday in the United States. Other Israeli officials later confirmed that announcement. A senior Palestinian official stated that talks would only move forward if they can be assured that topics of discussion would center around the 1967 border between Israel and Palestine. The official also wants to plan the release of all 103 political prisoners that were jailed before 1993. These assurances must be made by Sunday for the talks to proceed. The opening of the light rail line between Portland and Milwaukee is slated for September 12, 2015. Highlights for the new Orange Line include the longest car-free bridge in the United States, over 7 miles of track, and 10 stations. The death toll in Syria has reached 100,000. UN Chief Ban Ki-moon seeks an end to the conflict that he believes has no chance of being settled through more violence and is pushing for a peace conference in Geneva soon. The conflict in Syria began with peaceful protests that turned violent as the Syrian government pushed back with military force 2 years ago. A California court upheld a ruling on dredge mining. The technique uses giant mechanical vacuums to suck up sand and gravel from the riverbeds to look for gold. The apparatus includes a hose, motor, and sluice box. Miners in California were removing the sluice box to try and sidestep the ban. However, campaign director at the Center for Biological Diversity, John Evans, stated, "No matter what you call it, if it sucks like a dredge and spews like a dredge, it's a suction dredge." Suction dredge mining was banned on all California waterways in 2009 by Governor Schwarzenegger and later upheld by Governor Brown. This has been the News at Noon. Thanks for listening. I'm Kristen Yount. Turn in every weekday at 5 p.m. for the latest in local, national, and international news, arranged and executed by volunteers.
And this is KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Oregon Symphony, presenting an evening of music and comedy with Steve Martin and the Steep Canyon Rangers, featuring Edie Brickell, Thursday, October 3rd at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. Tickets and information for Steve Martin available at orsymphony.org. That's orsymphony.org. Welcome to Moving On. This is Ed Melnick sitting in for Lori Sonnenfeld today. Hope you'll stay with me for a lot of great folk music.